Hey, everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, returning for a quick look at a baffling mystery that remains unsolved, which is the disappearance of Josh Guimon. On November 9th, 2002, shortly before midnight, the 20-year-old college student left a party at St. John's University in Stearns County, Minnesota, and was never seen again. 20 years later, there is still no evidence related to where he went or what might have happened to him along the way. He simply vanished. And since the clues in this case don't lead to his fate, let's take a look inside his head, to the best of our ability, and see if we can extract a psychological profile that lends insight to his movements that fateful night. So let's start back at the beginning, before going to college. Josh was a driven high school student, someone who not only had dreams of becoming a state representative, like a family member had achieved before him, but also the president of the United States. On a more short-term basis, he wanted to enter the realm of law and follow his pursuit of a bachelor's degree at St. John's by attending law school. At the time of his disappearance, he was already on a pre-law educational path and was preparing for a mock trial with other students. In high school, it seems Josh was popular and funny, voted most likely to succeed, and in his sophomore year, caught the eye of a classmate named Katie, someone he ended up dating for the remainder of his high school years. The two were serious about each other and their education as it pertained to their future together. Now, if you recall the Amy Lynn Bradley episode I did a while back, we had a young woman who, on the verge of leaving home for college, had both the expectation of her parents that she would eventually find and marry a good, successful man, and her own conflicting desires of seemingly wanting to explore her identity as a lesbian, something she was unable to accommodate to that point. That goes for a lot of young people who aren't traditionally predisposed to being heterosexual in a home in which it's expected that they will be. Often, college serves as the first home in which a young person has the true freedom to express their sexuality, especially if it conflicts with the values in the home in which the person was raised. So Amy, wanting to get with women and having conservative parents who wanted her to be with a man, decided to attend a very small liberal arts college, well known for having a very significant lesbian enrollment, but one which was considered a sister school or twin to an all-male college directly next door. So while she was able to indulge her true sexuality at this all-women's liberal arts college, what her parents would see from the outside looking in is that this school is connected to one attended by a lot of young men from prominent, wealthy, and successful Southern families. Amy, a phenomenal basketball player, received scholarship offers from other, larger, and more prominent schools, and actually became the first person at this little college to receive a full scholarship to play women's basketball. Now, if she was the only person who ever chose to do this, meaning that every other person before her in this situation decided to go to a bigger, more prominent school, why would she limit her experience? Why, when other young women playing basketball, some of whom are lesbians too, choose bigger and better schools for their athletic and academic pursuits, is Amy resigning herself to playing at this one, where she, essentially, won't know anybody? Well, simply because it fits her needs, and considering that she was not out, so to speak, and was hiding her sexuality, what element could we say drove her decision beyond any other? Secrecy, discretion, being found out. Now, if you attend an all-women's college, even if you're straight, what does it mean people will see you doing? They'll constantly see you with women, and perhaps only women. But since the college is only open to women, what it says is that if you are only seen with women, those sightings will not be categorized as being sexually driven pairings or couples, or more specifically, lesbians, but instead always be allowed the basic context of two students interacting. Yet Amy, as she's likely been pretending for a long time, especially doesn't want to have to pretend that she's into men any longer. So to satisfy her parents, those men I mentioned are right next door instead. But to satisfy herself, those men actually attend a different college, so she can avoid them too. If you avoid men and place yourself in a situation in which everyone around you is a woman, you essentially guarantee that everyone who hits on you is going to be a woman, and because everyone else who is not a lesbian or bisexual, etc., is going to be a heterosexual woman, then what it says is that the only people who will hit on you are lesbians. Everyone else will leave you alone. This is a very simple reaction to trauma induced by having to pretend. Amy likely had to pretend she was interested in men in the company of her family, company she'd have to keep at all times prior to college. There is no escaping to freedom as a kid, so sometimes those teen years in which people want to explore their sexuality become the years in which they actually have to hide it instead. Therefore, when they reach college, they can sometimes make decisions contrary to what seems good sense, like Amy choosing to play basketball at this tiny school when she could go somewhere much better, because her priority is a secret. And I think we have the same thing going on here with Josh. 99 out of 100 women getting that basketball scholarship, even if they're all lesbians, are going to choose the bigger, better school because they are not traumatized to an extent that the context creating this choice leaves the confines of basketball and education. If you are traumatized to the extent Amy seemed to be, however, then you inexplicably choose chopped liver over the finest steak, and sexuality becomes the foremost consideration, as your true sexuality has been repressed to this point. So if we examine Amy's physical location in college in terms of being at an all-women's college linked to the all-men's college next door, how could we define her choice when distilled to the most essential ideas? Well, we could say what works best about those colleges for Amy is that they're together but still separate. With tons of men next door, it satisfies the notion that she will find a great man there. But with them being separated from her, it says they won't actually be able to bother her. And with tons of women at her small liberal arts college, it says she will only be pursued by women. So here we have Amy, a strong academic performer with an outstanding athletic pedigree, choosing sexuality as the context in which her decision about higher education should be made. On the surface, it sounds irrational, but as humans, what we do is seek ways to compensate for our trauma, meaning physically manifested ways of dealing with our emotional trauma. Amy's teen years at home were likely mired in expectations related to blossoming romance with men. And what's so traumatic about that circumstance is that such people often comply because A, they don't want to disappoint their families, and B, they're afraid of the fallout of the secret getting out. So, with Amy, we see her college experience, while it should have been designed to accommodate academics and basketball, actually took the shape of what was necessary to explore her sexuality while maintaining the secret. Keeping the secret was her primary focus. So let's look at Josh and Katie in that light. These high school sweethearts eventually graduate and are headed off to college. Now, what was that theme I just mentioned? Together but separate, remember? So Josh decides he's going to attend St. John's in Minnesota, which is all male. But he and Katie are still a couple. So how do we get that theme of together and separate from this? Well, Katie says the two plan to go to law school after their undergraduate work, so it's apparent that the two would be side by side in this arrangement. Therefore, to manifest the notion of separate but together, Josh enrolls at St. John's, an all-male school, making Katie's decision by default, which is to enroll directly next door at the all-women's college, St. Benedict. Now, the obvious draw for people in a situation like this, looking to escape the confines of their repressed sexuality, is that, if you're thinking it, so are a lot of other people. So yes, somebody like Amy Lynn Bradley, while at this liberal arts college, would have the opportunity, for the first time in her life more or less, to indulge others who had been through the same trauma of always hiding. We go in search of people who are like us because there is no gift greater than being understood in this world. We are burdened with this enormous question of, who am I? And to be in the company of those like us helps us define that answer. And perhaps the most terrifying part of it is that these people who have always been forced to be somebody they're not suddenly find themselves with the opportunity to be their true selves, and they don't know what that is. They have to go looking. They have to keep searching for their true identity, while ironically and simultaneously trying to hide it. You don't even know who you are yet, but you're so afraid somebody else might find out that you're trying to hide that unknown identity from anyone who might come to realize what it is. That repression makes it difficult to trust people. And worse, the fact that you're trying so desperately to hide means that the people you need to find most and who need to find you have very little to no chance of succeeding because there's so much risk involved. If someone finds out the truth, your world will come crashing down. Or at least you fear that it will. The truth is that if people find out, it would just force you to dispense with the bullshit and be your true self. In fact, the best thing for you is to have the secret become known by all. It is the ego that prevents us from letting the secret get out, and therefore we have to live a lie. So it is the best thing for the secret to come out. However, that's emotionally, inside your head. But out in the real world, there are still people who will punish you for what you are, from strangers to family. If it's the year 2000 and you have plans of becoming president of the United States, being an openly gay or bisexual man would likely be significantly detrimental to your political plight. Yet in the history of politics, there are countless examples of men who have fronted their home lives with a woman when in fact that marriage was just a facade to conceal the truth. Political aspirations are the stuff of appearances and rarely the truth. So from a political standpoint, having a woman by your side but being sexually active with men in the background would be a normal occurrence. But here's where these things get ugly. If you exist in a place in which a certain type of person, such as yourself, would benefit from hiding and believe there are others like you within, it also means that these other people, as we see in society, are going to have a full range of desires, spanning from the innocent act of seeking love to committing murder. People in these situations have been traumatized emotionally, but those who have been hurt the worst are the ones who are going to be most desperate to compensate. And if somebody killed you inside your head, then it stands to reason you might project that self-loathing onto another person by killing them outside it. Sometimes people looking for love find only pain, and if they've been exposed to that environment long enough, their options for compensating are reduced to physically employing the equivalent of causing others pain, specifically pain leading to death. they equate the victim's physical death with finally achieving emotional peace. When we're emotionally affected by something, we say it moved us. So when a dead victim has stopped moving, it means peace has finally arrived, as physical movement is simply a manifestation or projected image used to accompany the emotional change with visual context. Now, at the time of Josh's disappearance, in November 2002, he and Katie are juniors in college, and despite their original intentions of being this power couple in the future, it seems they actually broke up over the summer, choosing instead to remain friends. Josh doesn't seem to move on to another woman. Instead, beginning at the start of October 2002, as far as we know, Josh is indulging Yahoo personals online, in addition to similar postings. We have to remember that this is before Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, and even MySpace, if I remember correctly. It was really easy to pretend to be someone else, and beyond that, there was very little risk involved in terms of someone uncovering your identity. For someone looking to hide behind their screen in anonymity, it was a dream. But as we understand all these years later, there's also a dark side to that. Yes, you can hide from everyone else and lie about your identity, and nobody ever gets hurt beyond these little lies. But as soon as the curtain is pulled back by an in-person meeting, or even just the sharing of personal details related to identity, the risk involved begins to skyrocket. What's worse is that, if you've been denied something, especially in relation to your true identity or authentic self, and love seems to come along that will erase that trauma, you want to believe it's real, and the predators seeking you already know that. Accordingly, it's probably not going to surprise anyone that this small, Catholic, all-male college suffered numerous abuse claims related to its abbey where the monks resided. There are stories of grooming and related inappropriate conduct, and it's not a secret why they were occurring there. The church is also a place where people can hide from who they are. So when combined with an all-male college, you have a situation in which a lot of terribly repressed men in denial of their homosexual feelings can go to try to do that which they wouldn't do in public. And that says, in big, bright lights, that if you were seeking someone who might fall prey to less than stellar logic born of incessant desire to be his true self and in relation to homosexuality, St. John's would have seemingly been the perfect place to find a victim. Now, just like the people using Yahoo personals, what do all the monks want as well here? Discretion. This is paradise for somebody looking to kill. You almost guarantee that your victim will go to the greatest lengths to never reveal who you are, even if he knows, as his greatest desire is to remain anonymous as well. Even if we tried, we could not create a better recipe for an unsolved disappearance than this one. Killers find their victims by locating the place inside the victim's heads where they hide and promising to help them get out. And they find those places very easily because they're stuck there too. Their actions basically say, "Let me take you away from this place where you have to hide." So in physicality, what would a killer do to lure Josh into his car? Promise to take him away from the place where he's hiding. And while Josh is hiding inside his head, like the monks, he's also hiding at St. John's. Now, if someone is closeted as a gay person, what do they really wish they could do but free of the consequences associated with it? Come out. So to make Josh feel emotionally driven to accommodate, the killer simply needs to have him indulge physicality that first says he's coming out and then tells us that doing so, meaning coming out so he can be with this man, creates a situation in which doing so allows him to be taken or driven away from a cold, dark place, aka the world outside his head, or Minnesota at midnight in November. When we indulge our true, authentic identity, our old self or ego is shed, and that person we were subsequently does what? Disappears. So what a killer would do is manifest Josh's emotional desires into physicality. Josh is driven to get away from a cold, dark, lonely place inside his head where he's pretending to be somebody he's not in order to achieve peace. So a person drives him away from that physical location and kills him. These tragic manifestations simply give the protagonist of the story what they want, but ironically, in the worst way. Your physical reality is a projection of your emotions. Those images are not occasionally symbolic and designed to implore meaning. They are exclusively that and nothing more. The images bring meaning and context to emotion. The emotion, however, is the baseline reality and not the images. The images merely support with context what the emotions cannot convey on their own. So think of yourself listening to a symphony in which you don't know the story. You can be incredibly involved on an emotional level in a symphony, but unless there are images or words to go along with that to add context, you are simply just experiencing an emotional movement. So in your life, to accompany that emotional movement, we have images that bring full context. Okay, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. As a true crime podcaster, I spend a lot of time researching, yet cramming all of that information inside my head isn't the tough part. For me, it's putting it to memory and doing so effectively, which requires the greatest mental acuity. And of course, the burden for consumers of this genre is the same. For that reason, I'm here today to talk to you about an elixir I discovered called Magic Mind. After using Magic Mind, I found myself experiencing a creative boost along with a burst of energy that really allowed me to dig into my work and maintain focus. Also, by using Magic Mind, I can cut back on coffee and not overindulge caffeine. It contains L-theanine to help increase focus and attention and avoid the jitters often associated with consuming coffee. I'm here recommending it today because it's formulated to assist with improving long-term memory and cognitive function. So go to magicmind.co/CCMM today and for a limited time receive 40% off your subscription and 20% off a one-time purchase using the code CCMM20. Again, that's magicmind.co/CCMM and the code is CCMM20. Now, back to the show. For the month of October 2002, in the aftermath of his breakup with Katie, Josh is using sites like Yahoo Personals to mostly engage young men in a sexual manner. At times, he also pretends to be a woman and messages heterosexual men. Other occasions find him engaging couples. Near the end of the month, however, something happens that rattles Josh. He reports a user for breaking the terms of service, and his phone card seems to show that he made a related call of 27 minutes at that time. We don't know the content of the call, but it seems Josh consecutively reported the user, made the phone call, and then immediately deleted his Yahoo Personals account. As far as we know, he didn't return to Yahoo Personals after that time. Again, we don't know what happened, but from what I gathered, it seems that Josh, after becoming more comfortable with meeting people on the site, began exchanging personal info, including his photo. If I had to guess, I'd say that somebody might have turned around and posted that photo publicly, or even used it as a fake to lure other people. We can't know for sure, but what we do understand, especially considering that nobody knows what happened, is that Josh was upset in relation to the idea of identity. If this act, at its foundation, was one designed to facilitate secrecy above and beyond all else, then the offending party most likely crossed the line in relation to his anonymity. It was likely a breach of trust, one that was allowed specifically by way of utilizing an online platform in which a user could remain virtually unknown. So, if you got burned like that online, what would be the only way to make sure that the person you were talking to was actually who they said they were? I mean, consider how tragic it is. Josh was online pretending to be someone he's not, even a woman. So what likely happened to him in return? Somebody burned him in relation to identity, which means what? The only way to know the truth moving forward is to meet people face to face. He knows he was lying to other people about his identity, and now knows that those people were lying to him. So the only way to create truth is to meet face to face. Now, let me give an example of how this can go horribly wrong, even short of murder. When I was in college back in the day, and chat rooms were very popular, one of my fraternity brothers met a girl named Denise on campus in a chat room. And strangely enough, he actually went on to become a lawyer, as Josh had decided he wanted to do, but anyhow. After hitting it off with this person in the chat room, she invited him to meet in person at a local fast food restaurant, and he was really excited to see what she looked like because they had a strong emotional connection online. Well, he arrives and doesn't see the girl, but there's a guy his age, a gay man from campus, wearing the same colored shorts and t-shirt the person he was supposed to meet described. It quickly became apparent that this was not a girl named Denise, but in actuality, a gay guy named Dennis who lived in the dorm next to us. My fraternity brother was so angry at the realization, and while he just walked out without saying anything at the restaurant, he later started making plans to beat the shit out of this guy for embarrassing him. He could not fathom why a gay man would engage a straight man online under the guise of being a woman and then show up like that's actually who the person wanted to meet and would think it's okay. And yet, the truth often is that people are on there pretending to be someone they're not so that somehow, some way, like we all hope, they'll be seen for who they really are without having to say it. Plenty of men who are living the lie of being straight go online looking and do so without actually admitting it. They have to come to the realization of what they're really doing. So just like a killer would lure Josh into his car under false pretenses, this young guy pretending to be a woman drew my friend to the local fast food restaurant, hoping that was the truth, that my fraternity brother would literally follow him to the realization of it. He didn't. He was enraged. Now, I talked him out of beating that guy half to death, but guess what happens a few weeks later? My neighbor in the next dorm room over, who was a male cheerleader named Joe, receives flowers from a woman named Denise. He tells me about it, and I relay the story to him that I just told you. So Joe makes plans to meet Denise, but knows ahead of time who, quote-unquote, she is, so instead of showing up, he just watches from afar. And it was Dennis again. Joe was straight as an arrow, but after failing with my fraternity brother, Dennis was still seeking a match and figured perhaps Joe, a male cheerleader, was gay. He wasn't, and he was really pissed off about what happened. Now, of course, both of these men that I just mentioned who were approached were straight. But what made them angry is that they were deceived. The deception caused both men to tell me that they wanted to hurt Dennis. I advised against it, as I could see what was wrong with Dennis emotionally. He desperately wanted to cause a man pretending to be straight to run into his arms where it would be safe. But by doing this from behind a barrier in which his true identity could never be assessed until meeting them, the obvious truth is that most of the time, he was going to be wrong, and the people on the other end were going to be emotionally hurt by the deception. So after being hurt by him emotionally, how did that desire to engage manifest physically? They wanted to hurt him. They wanted to cause him pain. A few weeks after that second incident, I was walking across campus and saw Dennis. He had two black eyes and appeared as though his face had been pulverized with fists. I never asked. I didn't have to. He did it again, obviously, and this time it cost him dearly. Yet Dennis was small, out of shape, and though he was somewhat heavy, he had a very delicate, effeminate manner, so the result was always going to be that Dennis got his ass kicked for doing this. But what if he was bigger? What if he was dangerous? And what if he picked someone up in a car, only to have that person freak out about who he really was and attack him for it? What if he fought back? What if he won? What if the conflict caused so much anger the fight ended in death? Dennis wasn't rationally pursuing these men because he believed himself to be correct about their sexuality. He was almost certainly going to be wrong. But what he wanted is for someone to believe he was one thing only to finally realize that he was something else, and for that to be okay when it happened, for it to be okay when he came out. But like he had experienced since coming out, people just kept beating him up and rejecting him for who he really was. That repetitious act of surprise, meaning, "I'm not who you thought I was," is what allows him to indulge an addiction to finally feeling what it's like to be accepted when coming out as someone other than who people always believed he was. But notice how risky and dangerous it is to implore symbolism in a world of reason and logic. Men having this done to them will feel nothing but humiliation and the reality of having been deceived, which is intentional. When a person comes out, the recipient of the information is basically receiving confirmation that the person coming out has been lying to them and deceiving them, whether implicitly or explicitly, at which point that person is reasonably expected to set aside their humiliation and offer empathy to the person who is no longer burdened because they had the strength and courage to come out and no longer lie. That's what Dennis wanted. He wanted someone, anyone, to show up and say, "Hey man, it's okay. I get it. It's okay to be who you are. You don't have to hide anymore." And he wanted that because he was hurting so badly inside. So badly inside, in fact, that to take that enormous beating on the outside only confirmed what he had felt to that point, what people were doing to him. But by manifesting the pain he was feeling on the inside, again, he guaranteed that the damage caused by it would appear
on the outside, where people could see it, where they could understand, where it would finally be worth it to hurt like that. And there he was, with his big black eyes and bruised face, desperate to prove it, walking all over campus, doing absolutely nothing to hide those injuries and everything to show them. So let's recount Josh's disappearance, and I think we'll see that he had his own dentist waiting for him outside that night when he disappeared. Now, in favor of seeing this event as foul play rather than an accident, we have to go back to the earlier part of November 9th. Josh and his roommate, Nick, who is also a close friend, receive an invitation to hang out with Josh's ex, Katie, and her friends that night. Nick accepts, but Josh declines because he says he has another party to attend. Josh ends up going to that party around 11:30 p.m. People there are drinking and playing poker, specifically Texas Hold'em. For anyone who isn't familiar with Texas Hold'em, it's a popular poker game where each participant is dealt two cards, commonly called hole cards, that are unseen by the rest of the table. Five more cards are then dealt face up on the table and are communal cards. Using your hole cards in combination with what's on the table, you try to make the best hand you can with five cards. So everything that's between you is transparent, like the cards on the table being face up, but everything you hold close remains a secret, even if only a thinly veiled one. Keeping that secret right up until the moment of truth makes you vulnerable and puts you at risk, so you don't show your cards until you're forced to do it. Likewise, two people who have met online in this era, one in which deception is not only rampant but easily perpetrated, might be like those hole cards, essentially remaining faceless and playing poker until forced to reveal themselves at the end. And when those two cards are turned over, as those who have played surely know, often it turns out that someone was fooled into thinking something was an oasis, when in truth, it was really just a mirage. So, a few minutes before midnight, at a time when Josh has only been at the party approximately a half hour, he gets up and, without warning or ever telling anyone where he was going, leaves this location. The door he used was supposedly along the same trajectory as the bathroom, so a lot of people thought that's where he went, until he never returned. It seems that even though numerous people witnessed him at the party or interacted with him, there was no one who knew where he planned to go. After the disappearance, two witnesses reported seeing Josh very close to the party and described his attire accurately. He'd turned onto a sidewalk that crossed a roadway bridge, passing them as they turned in the direction from which he came. They didn't see where he went from there, but they reportedly did look back at some point, and Josh was no longer there. Josh was never seen again, to the best of our knowledge. An obvious assertion is that he had an accident and fell into icy water somewhere, a very believable theory because there are so many bodies of water present. However, while local waterways were thoroughly searched and canines were brought in to track Josh's scent, there has been no definitive determination of where he might have met his fate. It seems the prevailing notion is that one of two things befell Josh that night. Either he went into a body of water, which has been investigated in a manner that suggests, but doesn't prove he did not, or he got into a vehicle with somebody who had bad intentions and was murdered before being disposed of elsewhere. Josh was apparently angry about the allegations of sexual abuse at St. John's Abbey, and their speculation that he intended to perhaps expose something, or even already knew something, that made him a liability. It's possible, of course, but this remains no more than a theory at this point. At least one dog in the search led them to St. John's Abbey, but the general confusion and inconsistency of the tracking put the results in question. Another, perhaps more likely scenario, involves a string of attacks on young men in the region, leading to the belief that Josh walking alone late at night made him the perfect target. It might have happened that way, but again, if we go back to the statement of the witnesses, who were a couple, they tell us that Josh passed them on foot, and then at some point just thereafter, he seems to have disappeared. So how did that happen? I don't believe Josh had any type of mental break in this incident. He seems to have made a choice to leave the party, and did so while coherent, and most importantly, decided to not tell anyone what he was going to do. In addition, there's some speculation that Josh might have been at his computer, or somebody was, after midnight on the night of his disappearance, because a music player on his laptop seems to have been used in a way that requires it to be manually operated. Josh's roommates, however, say he was definitely not home when they returned that night, and according to his key card, which was used to get into the dorm, that seems to be the case, that he was not recorded going in the door. After the vanishing, it was learned someone had used a program called an internet washer to at least partially erase the history on the hard drive of Josh's laptop. Some believe this was done by someone involved who was worried that the info within would lead to him and the truth of what happened to Josh. But I would suggest it's more likely that people close to Josh discovered sexual material considered to be gay and wiped it. Of course, that's speculation, and there could be a simpler explanation for it. If you ask me what was going on in his life that might take place around the time he'd be partying, something that involved the greatest secrecy due to his future ambitions, and combine that notion with the fact that he was experimenting with gay interactions online for a month preceding this night, and perhaps before, and also became frustrated and angry about an online interaction, it seems most likely Josh was getting picked up for an in-person meeting. Whatever he planned to do, he obviously couldn't do it where he came from, or in his vehicle, so if he left on foot and suddenly disappeared without telling anyone, I'd say he got into a vehicle with someone who turned out to be other than what he expected, the tragic manifestation of what he'd done online. He was hiding behind a mask, so to speak, pretending to be someone else, and I think he ultimately found himself a victim of the same. That's how tragic fate works. Except that this monster came out of the screen and pulled him into the void. The universe always mirrors your worst emotional fears at you in physicality. Like I talked about earlier, I think what might have transpired is that the person who picked him up was someone different than how he'd advertised himself and was hoping for empathy or even sympathy, like Dennis, in the sense that maybe Josh was that person too, and like him, unable to say it. He's trying to help. I'm guessing there was some type of physical altercation, and that this person had come prepared for it, knowing the risk. On the other hand, we don't hear reports of Josh being armed. He seems to have believed something that wasn't true, or at least believed it long enough that once he wanted to turn back, he was already caught inside the spider's web. That's the scary part. If it happened this way, they both needed to believe something that's a lie, and that necessity or desperation comes from suffering emotional trauma. I think the monster who picked him up was a narcissist who knew that what he was ultimately going to do was take Josh from this place to a world where Josh no longer had to be that person anymore. The dramatic performance was finally over. He would offer the peace of not having to pretend any longer physically, because it's something he never found emotionally. I think that's what this person wanted. The same thing as Josh. The same as us. To not have to pretend anymore. Freedom blossoms with that. The truth. We perform at different times and for different reasons, but beneath that facade is always someone else who is trapped inside, waiting to get out. The person we could be. The new one waiting right down the road for us. Except we're stuck, unable to move forward, afraid, but dreaming, wishing, and hoping for someone to take us out of this place, to take us away.